everyone. It's Dr. BCW with Beyond Clinical Walls. I'm excited to bring my next guest forward. Her name is Pam Cusick. She is a public health professional. She has a 30-year background in expertise in study design, implementation, and analysis, as well as a background in public health communications and research, where she hopes to raise awareness and raise the importance of sharing patient and caregiver stories in hopes of reducing inequities and disparities. She has such an amazing background. So I'm just going to kind of shower a couple of those pieces in there. She was the special projects manager at Artix, where she managed key corporate initiatives, including research, public relations, marketing, and human resource programs for a management consulting organization. She has also partnered with multiple healthcare companies and consumer goods, as well as entertainment industries, such as Satellite Radio and Artix. Well, Pam, thank you for joining me on Beyond Clinical Walls. It is a pleasure to have you on the show, and I would love for the listeners to learn a little bit more about you.
Sure. I'm so happy to be here. I started my career in a as you said, public health research organization, working in the late 80s on an FDA program focused on blood banks and the AIDS epidemic. And it was a really interesting project where we focused the research on communication style. So figuring out what was the best way to screen people who were at risk for HIV from the blood supply. We tested and found that, well, surprise, direct communication and clear communication helps people to understand what the information is and what they should do. So that kind of spurred my career focusing on research and evolved into working on other programs for CDC and NIH. And I really loved and, you know, enjoyed those projects because you could see the larger impact on, you know, the different disease communities, but the public at large. I worked on different vaccine programs and things. So it was really interesting. And then fast forward, I had an opportunity to work for a pharmaceutical market research company in the late 90s when direct-to-consumer advertising came, you know, on the scene. And the company we worked for really had focused mostly on physicians because that's the only person you could go to communicate that information to. So with the advent of DTC advertising, they needed to know how to communicate with patients. How do we get this message across? So I worked for some time in that organization, and that was fantastic and really interesting work. My focus was mostly focus groups and interviews, more qualitative research, but working on a lot of different interesting programs and figuring out how is the best way to get patients to, say, ask their doctor about a particular program or medication. So, you know, that was a fantastic and interesting job. And in that position, I met Wes, who started Rare Patient Voice. So, you know, fast forward many, many years, he started Rare Patient Voice. And I said, hey, when you, you know, need somebody, let me know, because I knew this is something that was really interesting and really needed. I've been here now for the past 7.5 years. And what we do is we connect patients with all kinds of research opportunities. So everything from, you know, interviews and focus groups and surveys to clinical trials where patient insights are sorely needed. Back to that, my prior life when we were doing the early DTC work, most people only went to physicians to say, well, what do you think the patient would like? What do you think the patient would need? And now we've come to a place where patients can tell you, well, this is what I experience and what I really need is X, and give their insights about clinical trial design. We often think, you know, from a scientific standpoint, okay, well, we need to draw, you know, this many vials of blood. Is that necessary? Or is that something that, you know, you could take 2 vials of blood and make it a more comfortable experience so then the patient would want to stay in a clinical trial? So it's those sorts of insights that you have to get from the patient and figure out what it is they need, what do they want. Oftentimes we'll have clients who they might have developed an app for a particular patient group as an example, but maybe they haven't ever gotten any input. Is it something that a patient would need, what they would want? Is it something that they can use? And if once it is designed, you should test it with them because they're the people who will use it. So there's so many unique and interesting ways that patients can participate in research. Parents of young children also participate in these studies, and caregivers as well. The more that we do, the more work we do, the more people we connect with, the need is ever growing. Everyone wants to be patient-centric, but I think it's only really coming to pass now where it's being taken seriously and more patients are joining these organizations like ours so that they can share their voice and be heard. And that's a really wonderful thing.
Pam, I always like to know the history. You talked about communication. You talked about how you were working with blood banks and seeing a divide in really being able to have a strong form of communication. And as you and I know, that is vital to the delivery of healthcare. I'd like to know a little bit more, what made you decide to even get into communication or even healthcare?
So it really was research. When I was in college and also in grad school, I was able to participate as a research assistant and really liked that, you know, developing a survey and finding the results and analyzing those. And then the same with qualitative, interviewing people and really getting down to why do they think about things this way? And what is it that drives their, what's their motivation? And understanding kind of the backstory of things. I really love that. So when I left graduate school, I wanted to work for a research organization and I didn't have a particular area I was looking at. And it happened that this organization, it's the American Institutes for Research, had an opening. They needed a data collector really for this project. And it just was meant to be. It was a great job, a really interesting organization. And within that, my experience there, I was able to work on projects that had to do with education, that had to do with healthcare, that had to do with test design and all sorts of interesting things. And I really found what I liked best was the healthcare focus, helping patients understand things a little bit better, helping them to make informed decisions because you've created a pamphlet that is written in a clear and direct way so that they can read it and make a decision that is good for their health and make sense to them. So it really was that first job that I had that helped me decide, yes, I wanted to be in research, but which area did I want to focus in? And so healthcare was where I landed and continued on. And as I said, some really interesting projects. I worked on a project for kind of a spinoff of that blood bank project for the WHO. And I was in India interviewing people about how their blood banks work and how they made decisions about who could donate and so on. And it was fascinating. And the cultural differences in what we require and what they required at the time, you know, people could have an operation if a family member donated blood. That was just their process. But from a standpoint of, you know, risk and HIV and the issues that we were working on at the time, that wasn't the best idea, right? Because you're going to want to donate for your family member who needs to have surgery, but you might not be the best person to donate. So, you know, understanding that there are cultural differences and ensuring that you respect those. And I couldn't go in and say, well, you can't do that because that wasn't my place, number one. But two, you know, they have a process and a plan and needed to do things in a certain way. And you have to respect that.
You know, I often, the one question I always ask on this podcast is why do you do what you do? And as you're sharing your story of even that first research job and kind of looking at the analytics, but then also thinking about outside of that, what could you do to help patients not only advocate, but also think about respecting different cultures, figuring out that kind of central piece in order to advance whatever you're trying to do, I think is so important. And for those listening, it's a nice kind of reminder that you're not constricted to one area in whatever you're doing. And if you want to reach more people, or if you want to do more, there's opportunity when you kind of just find that passion, you lean into that curiosity, and then just build with it. And that's what you've been able to do. When, you know, I read your bio and hearing your story, this kind of roadmap that you have created for yourself, all centered around patience. And you talked about this patient centricity. That's the goal of all of us. We always hear mm-hmm. about put the patient first. I think when we talk about that, as you mentioned, there are so many different elements that have to be in play to put that patient first. If we can take a step back and look at whether it's an app we're building, whether it's, you know, a design, a study, if we focus on, does it have that patient at the forefront? Are we being sensitive to their culture? And all of those areas that are so important, that's when we're really going to be able to move that needle and advance health equity. And your work is really about sharing the stories of patients and caregivers. And if you haven't taken note of their thoughts, their concerns, their experiences, you're not able to really make them the focus. I'd love for you to kind of tell me some of the things that you're working on right now that are really kind of transcending healthcare.
I think one of the things that is really interesting to me, and I alluded to this before, is the involvement of patients in protocol design for clinical trials. That to me is huge, because there is so much, you know, involved in a trial. There was a woman that I worked with who was in a trial. It was in multiple phases of a trial for Fabry disease over the course of 12 years. And she would have to fly to a location and then fly back multiple times a year. And all she was doing was giving her health history and getting a blood draw. And she said in the conversation that we had that if she had realized, or if someone had realized that, well, how about if you send her to the local hospital and they do it? She said, I missed all that time with my family, just that going back and forth and back and forth. And because it's a condition that is genetic, she wanted to be in the trial and make sure she helped. But the truth of the matter is, it was not done in a way that was suitable to a patient. And so I think that having patients involved in trial design is absolutely essential. I don't know, you know, when it began, but I don't think that people have been doing that for that long. And I don't know if everybody does. Hopefully they are doing that now more so. But finding out is, you know, if I have to bring my child, you know, across the country multiple times, and that's a burden in and of itself, but then how many times are you going to draw his blood while we're there? Because the recruiting for clinical trials is really hard. There's so many inclusion and exclusion criteria, and people don't always get to that next step. And so now if you have someone who qualifies, you want to keep them in the trial. And doing that is probably one of the hardest things, because if you don't talk to patients and find out before you design the trial, you know, how many times, you know, can I get you and your child across the country before you think you would not come anymore? Those are important questions to ask, because if my child is screaming and crying because they've been stuck four times in a visit, I might not be able to or want to bring them back. And so enrollment is one thing, but keeping people in a trial is really, really difficult. So I think that's one thing we're seeing more of, is people being invited to those kind of design sessions where they're talking about the protocol and understanding sort of what can a patient bear in one visit and what can they handle and still stay in the trial. And I think that's really important.
I think that is such an important piece that you mentioned. Whether they're in a clinical trial, whether they're in the hospital, whether they're in an office visit, you have to think about what that patient is taking in, what they're experiencing, and what is the long-term goals for that person as well. It's a mutual relationship that I feel is often forgotten. So when you were bringing up her story, you know, how much time was taken into sharing in advance so she would know, you know, what to expect. And when you hear those kind of barriers that could be like the travel and so forth, what are we doing to augment that, to mitigate that beforehand? So you make such an important point that before we even start the process, looking at it holistically and thinking about what parts are really prohibitive for this trial to be successful. And then also taking another step back and look at, if you didn't even have enrollment, what things were prohibitive for you to even get enrollment. So there's all those areas. And so that struck me, but please keep, please continue.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it is, you know, they're very interesting topics because there is, you know, there is a lot to it. And in terms of what can help patients and keep them in trials, there are organizations that help with travel and, you know, and payment and things like that, so that, you know, they don't have to pay out of pocket for a flight or a hotel. But I don't know that that's always used either. And that's another piece that if you were to ask patients, what are the things that keep you out of a trial? What makes you want to be in a trial or not? Some of those things have to do with logistics. We did an internal study with patients, and that was a big issue. You know, the logistics, figuring out how I'm going to get not only myself or my child to this trial, but what am I going to do with all my other kids that are at home? And what am I going to do with my house and my bills and my job? And there are some organizations that have programs to help with those things. So knowing that, you know, ahead of a trial, here are the things that are barriers. What can you do to help with those things? And then do those things, because you want to keep people in your trial. I mean, in the end of the day, if you can, you know, fully enroll and complete a trial and your product can go to market, you can help all of those patients and more. And if you don't do the legwork up front and hear from patients and caregivers and what they need and what can help them to continue on, that product might never go to market, because it might not, the trial might not end, or it might take so long, you know, it might be too late for some people. So that's really important. Another thing that I've seen more often, which I love, is that oftentimes once a trial is done, there's a publication of some sort, and it's in, usually in kind of physician speak or scientist speak. But we see some of our clients who are actually making these into patient-friendly research results, you know, reports. So those things that, you know, I can then see, oh, well, I have this condition and there was this trial. I'm going to bring this to my doctor because it makes sense to me, as opposed to seeing something with a bunch of scientific jargon and not really understanding. So in the end, does it really make sense for me or not? So we do have clients who are, you know, bringing patients into that process to help make things more understandable. Medical publishers, that's another area where there are innumerable journal articles or journals focused in different areas. So psychology or psychiatry and heart disease, all these different journals with great information that sometimes has no patient perspective in it. It's about the patient and the treatment, but I know that there are some medical publishers that are working in those areas too, to bring in that sort of patient-focused language and understanding so that it's usable for patients, which is fantastic.
That part is so important, because when we talk about health literacy, if it is not digestible, if it's not informative and engaging in all three of those pieces, you're not able to really make those advancements or help that patient in whatever you're trying to put forward. And your example is a great example in respect to, you've got these results from a clinical trial or these outcomes, but how can the patient use it? How can the patient deliver it to their physician and have a robust conversation that leads to a different health outcome, or leads to that patient leaving that exam room feeling informed and feeling like they can make the best decision for themselves or their family members? And that's something we have to kind of figure out as we're doing it, people are reshaping that landscape, but we have to invest in that. When you brought that story up, Pam, it makes me think about my med students and my residents. I always tell them, I'm like, first and foremost, I feel as a physician, it is the best job ever. And I'm so grateful to be able to deliver care. And it's something that you should cherish. But you can be extremely intelligent, have these amazing board scores. But if you can't deliver the information to your patient where they feel like they can consume it, understand it, and have a relationship with you, it doesn't matter in the end because that information has been lost and not been able to be put forward, which is why as a physician, you want to help that person. And so being able to reshape health literacy and put it in a way that is non-judgmental. And I think that part, we have to continue to think about that through all areas of healthcare delivery in a disarming way and hopes that that patient can not only feel informed for themselves, but create that generational form of health literacy for their family members and so forth. Because that, again, not only for just in that patient interaction, but just think about their interactions with clinical trials, their interactions with physicians, healthcare providers, because all of that also encompasses trust as well.
Right. Absolutely.
So important. Well, I loved this conversation. I think this is going to be part one of many where we talk about other sectors in health and talk about the other advancements that you and your company are doing to really unroof the healthcare system, the landscape, and put patients first. And that's why I was so excited to connect with you, because that is what your core mission is. And it's been lovely. So please share with everyone how they can get in touch with you.
So if someone wants to get in touch, they can find me on LinkedIn or email me at pam.cusick@rarepatientvoice.com. I'm happy to, answer any questions people have. If there are patients that are interested in participating in research, you can go to our website, rarepatientvoice.com, and there's a sign up button where you can go and you can learn more. There's all kinds of information on the website, but you can sign up and participate in research and share your voice and be involved in making healthcare a better place for all patients.
Excellent. And I love that you are honoring being heard. You're honoring their experiences and then putting it forward to help. And that's the goal. So thank you, Pam, again, for joining me on Beyond Clinical Walls. This is Dr. BCW. As always, I like to extend a level of gratitude for your time and your energy. Don't forget to subscribe and turn on notifications so you don't miss my next upload. And if you found this information helpful, please hit the thumbs up. It really helps the channel. As always, thanks for watching and thank you for your support.